Today, the madness of modern monetary theory. Hello, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance, economics, and property with an Australian flavour. So, I'm joined by John Adams, our economist. Hello, John, good to see you.
How are you going today?
Very good, thank you. So we're going to do some really deep diving today into the economic questions of what happens if we actually do hit that iceberg that we've been talking about in previous shows from an economic perspective.
Yes. So today we're going to look at a theory called modern monetary theory. And when you had Stephen Keen on recently, he referred to this theory. And I think in the interview, he said there were certain elements that he agreed with, but most people don't know what modern monetary theory is. Now, the reason why this is important is that what your viewers need to think about is that when the crisis that I've been writing about comes, what will be the response of Parliament, but also of the Reserve Bank, so fiscal monetary policy largely, but also with APRA, with effectively banking policy and the availability of credit in the economy, but also what are the underlying frameworks and theories that underpin that response. So this is something that the mainstream media really hasn't delved into. Now, when we saw the GFC, we saw the Rudd government in particular with the Reserve Bank respond with a standard Keynesian response, which was that the cash rate went from 7.25% down to 3%. So that's expansionary monetary policy. And we saw two very large stimulus packages coming from the Rudd government. So this is what they call fiscal stimulus. So, they had certain implications. The reaction of that was to ensure the economy did not go into recession, although there was other factors at play, including work choices, which actually kept people in jobs because there was sufficient flexibility in the labour market. So during that GFC period, work choices was the law of the land, and that had a significant impact in terms of giving business flexibility to adjust their cost base to keep people in jobs while keeping their doors open. But also the global stimulus package that was rolled out, particularly by China, and China had the largest stimulus package. So those were significant impacts that resulted from the response. But obviously, because we didn't go into recession, we didn't address the imbalances in the Australian economy then, we have travelled on 10 years on to the greatest bubble in the history of the country, rather than dealing with the sort of bubble that we had in 2008. And remember, in a previous episode, the Reserve Bank in 2007 said that the bubble in 2007 was larger than the 1880s in the 1920s. So now, where we need to go from here is, so a few months ago, I was in federal parliament doing the rounds, talking to certain members of the government, particularly on the backbench, about the structural imbalances in the economy in terms of the bubble, and to educate members of parliament about what is really going on. So I had a very interesting conversation with one MP who didn't think that the issues that we were talking about were of particular concern. And his reaction, which stunned me to the core, was that if we have a crisis and the government is short $50 billion, we will go to the Reserve Bank and just print it. So that was the response. Now, going back to our third episode about money, when you print money, it actually devalues the value of that money. So obviously, as a classical or Austrian economist, you know, this sort of response from a member of parliament is quite shocking. And it was such a cavalier delivery when he said it to me, no worries, we'll print the $50 billion. We'll plug any holes in the financial system and we'll just carry on. And there's no concerns. Now, when he said this to me, I immediately started to inquire, why do you think this is a good idea? Where did this come from? And this is where the member raised modern monetary theory And he talked about particularly the writings of Professor Bill Mitchell from the University of Newcastle, who is one of the key global academics who put this theory together. And in that discussion, I was asked, am I aware of what MMT was? I said I had heard of it, but I was honest. I said, it's not something that I have studied, but I committed to the MP that I would go and read about it. I would study it. I would come back to him with my views about it, given some of the statements he said in this conversation. And so that's what I did. Now, during this week, I published an op-ed called The Madness of Modern Monetary Theory. So I've gone through this. I've gone through some of the claims that the proponents of the theory have put forward. I think that some of the claims are quite fanciful. I don't think they're backed by empirical evidence. And we're going to go through some of those claims today and why I think they're deficient. But I think it's fair to say to the viewers, I wouldn't say that MMT is a well-established consensus in Parliament, but there are definitely certain people who have looked at this, who think it makes sense, and who think that if a crisis were to occur, this can be deployed. And obviously this will have significant impacts on your viewers, the ordinary Aussie, and I think it's incumbent on your viewers to actually understand what this theory is and for them to make their own minds whether the MMT is a good idea or a bad idea, and then obviously for them to question their members of Parliament and figure out whether they subscribe to this theory or not.
So just a couple of questions before you dive into the particular elements of it.
Yeah.
Firstly, is this a sort of a building block of parts? In other words, is it a complete theory or is it a series of elements that come together, clustered around the MMT umbrella?
I think the proponents would say that it is a comprehensive theory. It's a comprehensive theory to address a specific problem. And the specific problem that they are most concerned about is involuntary unemployment. Mm-hmm. So basically people who want a job who can't get a job. At the moment, unemployment in Australia is about, I think, roughly 5.5%. I think most economists would say that we are not at full employment at the moment. And so MMT would say that there are a whole host of Australians who either don't have a job, who want a job, or who want more hours, but the private sector can't produce the sufficient hours for them to work. And so for them, they consider that to be the greatest economic evil. And so MMT has been constructed to solve that one question.
And that's presumably because the idea is that if people are actually in employment, then they're going to be earning. If they're earning, then they can be effectively a productive member of society and also spend as well. And so therefore they're not a burden to the state and all those things that follow from it. Is that right?
So all of that is correct, but this issue of the burden of the state. Mm. Now, MMT at its core believes that to resolve this issue of involuntary unemployment, the government, and let's be specific here, the government that issues the currency, so in the Australian context, this is the federal government that issues the Australian dollar, not the states or not local government. So the federal government should employ a job guarantee program that anyone who can't get a job or who can't get sufficient hours will be employed by the federal government, and that's how you reach full employment.
Right.
So it is a burden on the state, in terms of my view, but they say that that's how you solve unemployment, and obviously the dilemma with that is how do you fund that employment of all of those sort of people, in terms of revenue, but also if you are printing money to employ all of these people, and they're not particularly clear about what specific jobs they will be doing, but if you do employ these people, how do you come up with the revenue? And if you're going to print money, how do you maintain the value of the currency? So they've come up with a construction that tries to skirt around these key questions and by making a series of claims.
Okay, and then my last question before we get into it is this a new thing or is it, resurrected from previous versions of economist thinking? Or I'm just trying to understand whether it is new and radical, or whether it's really old, just reheated.
So I think it is more of the same sort of traditional Keynesian economics, but some of the elements and some of the claims I think in the economic literature are quite new, and obviously, you know, once we go through specific claims, but also once we go to my responses to those claims, I think some of these things are going to fall apart.
Okay, so let's get into it. So who created it and what is it really about?
So there's a whole host of international academics that came up with this MMT theory, and the leading proponent in Australia is Professor Bill Mitchell from the University of Newcastle, and he was the one who coined this term modern monetary theory. So obviously, by its very term, he's saying that we have a modern interpretation of what money is, how money works in the economy, and because we have come up with a new construction, therefore some of these traditional economic challenges of involuntary unemployment can be resolved using this in terms of this new theory. Now, MMT makes a number of specific claims, and we'll listen to the professor in certain recent lectures also make those claims.
The latest fad is around the world is so-called fake news. But as a macroeconomist academic, fake knowledge is nothing new to me. The dominant mainstream approach to macroeconomics is fake knowledge. Its knowledge content is virtually zero. So the economics that is taught in the majority of universities around the world, and the policy advice that is derived from that, is fake knowledge. This is a nice quote from the US philosopher, and it's confronting to my colleagues when I tell them that everything they teach is lies, majority of it. It's confronting when I tell them that they're teaching fake knowledge, because everyone wants to feel worthwhile in their workplaces, and so they should. But there's just simply no polite way of telling people that they have dedicated their lives to an illusion. We assert that all markets are efficient, and what that means is that they'll always produce the best outcomes. We do some trivial mathematics to prove that, and ultimately we always are able to prove that use of fiscal policy is ineffective and austerity is good. And then we get some data and we realise our models don't fit the data very well, and they fail, so therefore we manipulate the data. And in doing so, we violate all of the original starting assumptions anyway, and so which was our appeal to authority of the knowledge. And we then publish articles and we get promoted. The knowledge quotient in that exercise, which goes on every day in our academic departments, is zero. That's zero knowledge being produced. It's ideological propaganda that's being produced. But we have we accept the neoliberal framing, which allows the ideological agenda then to continue, as if it's authority and justified. And what MMT allows you to do is break out of that framing, and the right-hand area is where we think differently. Break out of that framing, which then forces different questions to be asked and different policy options to be proposed. Here's an example that I've already mentioned it briefly. It's often said, and Malcolm Fraser, when he was Prime Minister of Australia, said, the Australian government's just like a household. Think about your household budget. We've got to balance that or we get into trouble. Malcolm, our Prime Minister, said that, and it's said often and over again. A Nobel Prize winner, Robert Barrow, wrote that the government budget is just like a household budget. And the point is that that's completely inapplicable. Our own personal experiences provides us with no knowledge relevant to consideration of government fiscal matters. Now, you'll note I don't use the word budget to describe government fiscal policy, because I'm trying to condition people to break out of that language that's built in this inapplicable analogy. We have budgets because if we want to spend as households, we've got to, before we can spend, we've got to work out how we're going to fund it because we've got a financial constraint. We've got to either earn income, run down savings, sell assets for money, or we've got to borrow. Well, a national government like the New Zealand government doesn't have to do any of those things. It has to spend without, it can spend without any financial constraint because it issues the currency. And you've got the private sector with record levels of household debt, unable to save overall, then a fiscal surplus in that context is the height of irresponsibility. In that context, a fiscal deficit is specified. And that is the usual context, where you've got an external deficit, and if you want your non-government sector to be able to save overall, then the government has to run deficits. That's what modern monetary theory insight teaches you. And the other way of thinking about it is if the government is running fiscal surpluses, that means it's taking more out of the economy than it's putting in terms of income, then that destroys non-government wealth. Now, why is that? Well, if they're taking more out in income than they're putting in via spending, where does the non-government sector get the resources to fund that surplus from our savings by selling our assets? So when Peter Costello in Australia was, between 1996 and 2007, was running down government debt because he was paying for surpluses, and saying what a wonderful person he was and how responsible that was, what he was effectively doing was destroying non-government sector wealth. He was squeezing the private non-government sector through running the surpluses, pulling more out than putting in, and forcing the non-government sector to then liquidate assets to be able to fund the surplus. So when a government, the mainstream economists and government says, oh, fiscal surpluses are good, and MMT will say, well, how is it good when a government is deliberately undermining non-government sector wealth? And the general idea is that if the growth in spending outstrips the capacity of the economy to respond to that growth by producing real goods and services, things, you know, cars and computers and stuff, then you'll get inflation. But if the growth in spending remains proportional and with the capacity of the economy to respond by producing real goods and services, you won't get inflation. And so therefore you know what the limits of government spending are. It's to bring all idle resources into productive use, and no more and no less. And a continuous deficit will not be inflationary if it maintains that proportional relationship between spending and productive capacity. Now, then the other point that economists teach their students, fake knowledge, is, oh, well, if the government... And by the way, I never use the word printing money, because that's a loaded term to immediately invoke out-of-control banks, central banks and governments, you know, wheelbarrows full of money and all of that stuff. That's the use of language to bias your perception. Because, in fact, governments don't spend by printing money. Governments spend by clicking on computers and numbers jump up in bank accounts. That's how they spend. There's no printing presses run at all.
Is it the government chooses the unemployment rate? The government, when they say, oh, well, we've got 6.2% of unemployed now, the government's chosen that rate to be the case. And the government could tomorrow make an announcement that anybody who wants a job, we've changed the Centrelink office, we're now calling it the Job Guarantee Office. Anybody who wants a job tomorrow, go down to the Job Guarantee Office, it's the same place where Centrelink was, and we'll put you on a job. And it might take a while to organise a job, but they'll be employed on a wage not a below the poverty line doll.
Oh, they had hyperinflation. I say, what else do you know? Not much. And what happened in Zimbabwe in 1 minute is that Robert Mugabe correctly wanted to do two things. He wanted to reward the freedom fighters that had broken the colonial yoke from the British, and he also wanted to reverse the insidious and incredibly unfair land tenure arrangements that had been in operation under the colonial system. And, you know, from a national solidarity perspective, you could think they were desirable things, policy of you know, good things. What he did was stupid, though, because the Zimbabwean agriculture sector was one of the most productive in the world, the food bowl of Asia. And what he did was he gave the farms to the freedom fighters who knew nothing about farming, confiscated them. And within a very short period, approximately 60% of Zimbabwean agricultural output capacity was decimated. In other words, a huge reduction in supply capacity in the economy. It was obvious there was going to be inflation. It told you nothing about running deficits. It told you everything about if you destroy the supply capacity of your economy and keep spending, then of course you're going to get inflation because there's not enough goods being produced. And a similar story could be told about the Weimar Republic and the destruction of the after the Treaty of Versailles, the destruction of the capacity in the Dusseldorf, you know, the Ruhr region, which was the steelmaking region. And the point being made is that all spending, whether it's government or non-government, carries an inflation risk. All spending. And the general idea is that if the growth in spending outstrips the capacity of the economy to respond to that growth by producing real goods and services, things, you know, cars and computers and stuff, then you'll get inflation. But if the growth in spending remains proportional and with the capacity of the economy to respond by producing real goods and services, you won't get inflation. And so therefore you know what the limits of government spending are. It's to bring all idle resources into productive use, and no more and no less.
Okay. So just sort of trying to get my head around that. We've got the concept of full employment, one way or the other, engineered.
Yes.
We've got the idea of printing money is okay as part of it.
Yes.
Right. And we've got that really that the government can really do what it likes because it's the guy in charge of the money, and therefore, you know, everything else follows from that. Is that how I'm seeing it?
Yes, yes. Okay. Although the thing is that, yes, so they have this arbitrary rule that if the growth of spending keeps pace with the growth of the supply side of the economy, then you're not going to have any inflation.
Okay.
So these are the claims that the professor makes, and there's, you know, there's a number of things that I think are completely wrong with that. Now, the first issue I have with this is what the professor talks in terms of the nature of money. So this whole notion that if resources in an economy are underutilized and then they are utilized, only when you start to spend more than that utilization of real resources, that causes inflation. This is a traditional aggregate demand, aggregate supply sort of theory that the Keynesian have put out, the Keynesian framework, but that doesn't sort of go to what the nature of inflation is. And as we said from the very first episode, and we covered it in episode 3, inflation is the growth of the money supply. And so typically if you're going to finance government spending in terms of a deficit, where do you make up the shortfall? You either borrow or you print the money, and by printing the money, you can then push the money into the government sector and the government can spend. But by printing the money, you devalue the currency. So that's where the real inflation comes from. But MMT doesn't really recognize that. And particularly, and I've listened to a number of these writers and authors, but particularly this professor, he doesn't recognize that central point. So the second issue I have with is, and to be honest, here's probably the crux of the issue, is this issue of hyperinflation. So... now, when you print too much money, and you devalue that money. And it depends on how that money comes into the system. If it's pushed through the banking system, then you're going to have excessive debt levels and you're going to have bubbles. And that's what we're seeing at the moment in the Australian economy. The bubble is in the household sector. If you look at Japan, the you know, public sector debt as a proportion of GDP is in excess of 250%. So the bubble with massive quantitative easing in Japan is in the government sector. China is in the financial sector, US corporate sector, etc. So what they say is that hyperinflation in these two examples, the first argument is if you print too much money, you're going to ultimately cause hyperinflation by the currency losing its value and people losing confidence to actually trade in that. So they basically say, well, Germany and Zimbabwe was not caused by excessive money printing. It was, in fact, caused by a fall in the productive capacity of the economy. And in Zimbabwe, what the professor said was that Mugabe introduced land reform. The land reform, rather than having white farmers grow the food in the food bowl in Zimbabwe, the black freedom fighters took over the land. They didn't know how to, they didn't know anything about farming, and the productive capacity of the agricultural sector in Zimbabwe fell 60%. And the theory goes that when you had a massive fall in the productive capacity of agriculture, less goods, same amount of money, that meant that the value of the goods went up, and that was the hyperinflation. And similar in Germany, the professor says that when it comes to the Treaty of Versailles, there was significant impositions imposed on Germany, and then in West Germany and the Ruhr region where you had massive industrial production that suffered massive falls in production after World War One, and that was the cause of hyperinflation. Now, that whole argument is completely wrong and fallacious. And let me give you an example of why that is. Now, in 2006, Australia had a massive cyclone in northern Queensland that really wiped out the banana crop. Mm-hmm. So we had, so the cyclone decimated between 90 to 100% of the North Queensland banana crop, or 80% of Australia's total banana crop. Now, before the cyclone, in early February, March of 2006, the price of a kilo of bananas was about $2, $2 to $3. By mid-July of 2006, in some parts of the country, a kilo of bananas went up to $14. So from 2 to 14, the rate of inflation was 600% because of a fall in the productive capacity of bananas. Mm-hmm. Now, so in this case, we had a certain crop fall by 80%. And in Zimbabwe, the rate of inflation was 231 million percent. So the professor is saying that when you have a fall in productive capacity, you're going to have that could lead to hyperinflation. And yet, when we had a very similar experience, but yes, it was one crop. But imagine if the entire agricultural sector of Australia fell by 60 to 80% of its produce, would we see 231 million percent inflation in Australia? The answer is no. Mm. Now, in Germany, the when they had hyperinflation in 1923, the rate of inflation was 322% per month. And again, if we had 60% of our agricultural production or industrial production falling, we would not see 322% rate of inflation per month. So this is one of the key premises that MMT says what happened with hyperinflation, and it's completely wrong. And therefore, for me, the theory falls apart. So a couple of other sort of issues that I have with the theory is that obviously MMT says nothing about when you print all of this money and you employ all of these people, what sort of structural imbalances do you create in the economy? Because when you print this money and it then goes out into the economy, even if it is only to employ idle labor, you will ultimately over time, because you've expanded the money base, you're going to create some structural imbalances, because you're going to see some bubbles in certain parts of the economy. So they say nothing about that. They say nothing about the productivity of the workers being employed by the government. So obviously, you know, you would expect that if someone's being employed by the government, they're going to be doing something useful, and that's going to be of productive use to society. They say nothing about the productivity of the workers being in terms of employed. So obviously, one of the things that they fail to say that if you do want to create full employment, rather than actually employing people via the government sector, you can actually do things with the private sector regulation, labor laws, taxes, corporate law, etc. Now, one example where it's hardly ever discussed in Australia is what happened in Singapore. So, you know, and to be honest, when I was working for Synodinus, I really didn't know much about Singapore. We actually had a couple of people from the business sector come in. They met the senator and they met me, and they started talking about Singapore, and they said, you need to look at Singapore because they did some fantastic things. So I actually was due for a holiday. So I said to the senator, I'm not going to go away for a week. And my wife and I went to Singapore for a week, got to see Singapore firsthand, got briefings from the private sector and the government sector, and really learned what happened in Singapore. And, you know, one of the most unique stories, I mean, they went from a third world country in 1965 when they had independence from the British to a first world country within a single generation. Never before done in human history, but they did it under the leadership of Lee Kuan Yew. Now, they had a very unique set of policies, but they actually were able to produce 2% unemployment with basically no minimum wage, no welfare state, very low taxes, very low government, and a government that was running, that had basically balanced budgets. So a completely different economic and philosophical approach to economic policy, and yet they got full employment at 2%. And in some cases, they got it even as 1.8, 1.9%. So if involuntary unemployment is such a concern, well, there is another pathway to achieving that pathway, and you don't necessarily need this MMT theory. And, you know, something similar to this sort of did come about in the 1920s in the UK. So the UK had higher unemployment. They had an unemployment problem compared to, say, the United States. Churchill, when he was Prime Minister in the 20s, reintroduced the gold standard. And because of the gold standard and the way it was introduced, John Maynard Keynes and a whole bunch of other economists said at the time, it was gold that was the cause of the unemployment. And that was one of the key catalysts for why Australia, the UK, and other Commonwealth countries got off gold in the 20s because of this argument. But if you look at labour laws and the role of labour unions in the 1920s compared to the US, where that wasn't playing a part, they could have actually got unemployment down through a completely different way. So these are my arguments to say that MMT doesn't stand up to independent scrutiny in terms of a theory, and yet we have at least one member of parliament, and to be honest, it's only one member of parliament who I've spoken to date who has said that he believes in this, he thinks it's sound, and that as we go into a crisis, if the government is short $50 billion and they can't raise it through taxation, they're just going to go print it and there'll be no consequences to society or to the value of money.
Okay, John. So let me just pick up those claims then, because we've had a really interesting discussion about them. So the first one was that modern economics taught in Australian universities is fake knowledge, and the content's virtually zero. So your answer to that is not true?
Well, I would say not true. So I think there's a lot of theories in university that are taught that are problematic, and I had some challenges learning some of these theories and then having to unlearn them and actually, you know, go off and actually figure out what was really going on. But I think the reason why the professor makes this certain assertion is because he's trying to undermine the whole profession and saying, you're completely wrong and you need to think of something completely different.
So you're really creating a bit of a false dichotomy rather than actually having perhaps a more discursive set of discussions around the different theories and options that are available.
Yes.
Okay. So the second claim then was that a government budget is not equivalent to a household budget.
So a lot of people in certain circles in society trying to make this argument. And obviously they are saying that, you know, that you make this point in order to advance different set for, you know, a different set of priorities. But I think, you know, that this proposition is completely false, because ultimately when you get a government that spends too much money, you see what happens in Venezuela, what is happening right now.
In other words, debt is debt is debt, whether it's in a household or when it's in the government, still got to be repaid.
Yes.
Okay. And the third one was a currency issuing government can never run out of money and is never to fund its spending.
Yes. So just to follow on from the other point is that if the government budget is not a household budget, well, you don't have the traditional constraints that you would understand of a household budget. So they basically say that you can that you can never run out of money and you can just print it. Now, ultimately, that doesn't hold true, because at some point, the unit of currency that the government is paying in, people won't accept that money because it is worthless. And this is precisely what is happening in Venezuela now. And there was an interesting article I read the other day where certain banks in Venezuela are now issuing gold certificates. So what they're basically saying to customers are, if you put your money in the bank, we will give you a certificate and you can come and either take your deposit or you can actually take gold on delivery. And this is, they have actually had to do this to reestablish confidence in the banking system, in the monetary system in Venezuela. So in theory, a government can continue to spend, but at some point, the people realize that the money is worthless, and then at that point, the debts of the government, become they rise astronomically in value. In terms of nominal value of that currency, because the currency becomes worthless. And I think when we're talking about money in episode 3, the first time a society tried to push the limits of printing excessive amounts of non-backed money was in China 1,000 years ago. And within 30 years, the currency became worthless and it died out.
Okay. So claim 4 was that governments need to run continual budget deficits.
So this claim 4 is for the non-government sector to save, the government needs to run continual budget deficits. And that to me is, you know, again, it is not a proposition that I would agree with. If you look at Singapore, for example, their national savings rate was around 40%. So the reason why they were able to jump from third world to first world in a generation was because they had higher rates of national saving. They were able to invest that saving into productive investments and create competitive industries, and they were able to generate wealth and obviously rise their economic prosperity. So the private sector did save, it had invested, and you did not need a government that ran continual budget deficits in Singapore. So again, the Singaporean example proves this statement to be completely fallacious.
Okay. And then claim 5 is that the government can ultimately choose the rate of unemployment.
So obviously, you know, going back to the previous propositions that the professor makes, that if you can spend, you know, willy-nilly, if there are no limitations, then ultimately the logical consequence is that the government can choose the rate of unemployment, because any ideal labor can be basically hired by the government. And then obviously, depending on what is happening in the private sector, maybe the private sector can employ 95% of able-bodied people or 99%. But obviously, they're saying that anything that's surplus, the government will have the ultimate choice. And to be honest, you know, some of these issues tend to play out over quite a number of years. So in theory, maybe today, MMT, if it was employed, the government can say, yes, we want an unemployment rate of 2%. We're going to have a massive public sector employment program, and we're going to employ 300,000 people. We'll get unemployment down to 2%. But ultimately, this is not sustainable in the medium to long term.
It goes back to what we said earlier on. You know, you trade off employment and debt. You can't square the circle with both.
Yes.
Okay. So And there's a whole bunch of questions that come flooding in at this. The first is, the thing that I'm really interested in is that as automation continues to come into society and as we get more and more technology, one of the big issues that I think I've got is that it's more likely that less people are going to be able to work because effectively technology is just going to roll over them, right? Now that's an interesting observation in terms of the problem with employment and unemployment. So it may be hard to find jobs, and even if you try to create jobs, I'm not sure there are going to be jobs there in any case. So I don't know whether that's worth thinking about, but that was sort of one observation. The second is that we said in one of our earlier videos that the Reserve Bank would likely take interest rates really, really low,
that's
maybe
right.
Even to negative territory.
Yes.
Right? That is a supporting and side-by-side strategy vis-a-vis printing money, isn't it?
Yes.
The two come together.
Yes.
Right? So, hypothesis, do you think there are people in the Reserve Bank who also share this same way of thinking about the economic situation that we're in?
Well, so whether the Reserve Bank believes that there is no consequences to printing money or not, I suspect they don't believe MMT, but faced with a crisis, and it's either depression, recession, or sacrificing the dollar, they will sacrifice the dollar.
Mm.
I had a conversation with an economist who used to work at the Commonwealth Treasury recently, and he basically thought that the standard Keynesian response, which is more money printing, more government spending, more government debt, more private sector debt, will be the response to prop up the bubble. Now, we'll probably at some point do an episode about gold and silver and what is that role, because there's obviously quite a few viewers who are very interested in that. But in full disclosure, I personally am concerned about the value of the dollar going forward. I have been buying physical silver bullion myself, and one of the roles that I'm doing separate to these conversations is I'm a chief economist at a gold and silver dealership that's based in Adelaide, and I've only had that relationship with them very recently, but my views on gold and silver have been established for many years.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So the thing I'm sort of trying to get my head around is that if in fact the root cause of all the issues we've got is this massive debt bubble that's been created because of the expansion of the money supply and all the things that we've been talking about, this approach that we're talking about here will just lift debt even higher, won't it?
Yes.
So isn't that an intrinsic part of MMT, that more debt is better?
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
So, when you listen to this particular professor, he doesn't really address some of these problems per se. He just says that the standard approach to macroeconomics taught at universities is completely wrong. You need to rethink of economics and macroeconomics in a completely different way. And he explains MMT to be a different lens of how do you look at economics and then how do you provide policymakers with different choices. But I think that if you, certain people may say, well, and I've had this conversation with several people in Parliament, once you go into a crisis, they say, well, we've got to take the least worst option. And now the question is that the least worst option over what time period? If you've got a political imperative to put out a fire now, well then you will try to inject new stimulus into the economy. But effectively, you're kicking the problem down you're kicking the can down the road, and the problems are going to be more severe and larger at a future point in time. If you want to take a more medium to long-term view and recognizing that money printing and more government debt and obviously pushing more credit via the banking system is going to be counterproductive in the long term, there are some people, and I am one of them, who would say, and I have told certain politicians, that if it came to a choice of sacrificing the dollar or depression, take depression. Now, there are ways, if you look through economic history, there are ways that you can engineer a deep recession or a depression and come out of it within 18 months. But you've got to have a specific policy program that would actually achieve that. But within 18 months, we could resolve the big debt bubble that we have and come out of this the other side with a fundamentally strong and sound economy where people don't feel squeezed by cost of living pressures and the level of debt within the economy is at a more manageable level.
So to put that another way, the choice is to perpetuate the debt bubble for another cycle, right? So yes. Basically you deal with the short-term crisis.
Yes.
But in so doing, what you're doing is building a bigger problem for later.
Yes.
Or fundamentally recognizing that debt is the problem.
Yep.
And effectively you architect your solutions and strategies and policies around dealing with the debt problem.
Indeed.
There are some implications of that in terms of, the impact on the economy, but actually that strategy of concentrating on fixing the debt problem puts us in a position potentially to deal with this in a more strategic way that means that we don't then have to keep going around this cycle again, the end kicking the can and kicking the can and kicking the can, right? Is that how you see it? Because that's what I think you've told me, but I'm not sure I'm reading it right.
Yeah, no, so I think you have it. Right. Now, I think some of your viewers, if they're hearing me say, Adams is saying, have a depression. Right. Oh my God, what is this guy saying?
No.
The reality that Australians need to realise is that from where we are today, there is no way in terms of getting out of this without pain.
Right.
So the question is, how much pain over what period?
Right.
Now, if we raise interest rates now aggressively, independent of the rest of the world, certain people will feel pain. We'll probably go into a recession. Probably not a depression, but a mild recession, and we could start to get the debt bubble happening, starting to get the debt bubble starting to deflate. But as we talked about in the last episode about the political imperatives, that's likely to cost votes. Politicians don't want to do that. So my biggest concern is that we are complacent now. I think, besides your viewers, most Australians are asleep at the wheel in terms of what the issues are. And the history of this country has been that something blows up overseas, we have been complacent, and we get swept right through it. And that is obviously what would appear that we are happening now. Now, obviously, I don't think we, compared to the GFC, I don't think we are as asleep compared to 10 years ago, because, we're talking about it. There's a lot more press about it. People in Parliament are aware about it, but the people who hold the power for political expediency are not willing to face the challenges.
Okay, thanks, John. So basically the message is beware MMT. It may sound alluring, but the implications and consequences potentially could be quite devastating.
Absolutely.
John, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very interesting.
Not a problem.
So there you have it, a deep dive into MMT. It may not be as good as advertised. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll catch up with you next time.